Pull up a chair. I want to take you back to a spring morning in 1924. Seattle, Washington. Cold water, gray sky, the smell of salt and engine oil hanging over Lake Washington. Four biplanes are riding on pontoons at the edge of the water, and every one of them is about to try something no human being had ever done: fly all the way around the world. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar, the place where we sit with the old stories and let them run a little long. And today we've got a good one. Because before there was a jet that could cross an ocean while you slept, before there was a satellite that could talk to your airplane over open water, there were four army pilots in leather helmets, open to the wind, trying to stitch a line around the whole planet with nothing but a compass, a map, and a lot of nerve. Now, before I get into it, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you, the fellas I'm about to describe earned every coin ever struck. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene properly. Back in the early 1920s, the airplane was still trying to prove it was more than a carnival act. The Great War had ended just a few years before. The world had watched airplanes drop bombs and shoot each other down, and a lot of folks figured that was about all they were good for. Noisy, dangerous, unreliable machines that fell out of the sky if you looked at them wrong. And the nations of the world knew it, so they started racing, not just for glory, for prestige. Whoever flew around the world first would plant a flag on the future of aviation itself. Britain wanted it, France wanted it, Italy, Portugal, Argentina, they all had teams gearing up. The race was on, and nobody had done it yet. The United States Army Air Service decided America was going to be first. And they turned to a man named Donald Douglas. Now here's where it gets interesting. Donald Douglas was a young airplane builder out in Santa Monica, California, working out of an old movie studio building. The Army came to him and said, "We need an airplane that can fly around the entire world. It has to cross oceans. It has to land on water and land on dirt. It has to survive Arctic cold and tropical heat. It has to be simple enough to fix in a field with hand tools, because there won't be a mechanic waiting for you in the middle of the Pacific." Douglas took a torpedo bomber he'd already designed and rebuilt it for the job. They called it the Douglas World Cruiser, a big, honest, open cockpit biplane. Two seats, one behind the other. Pilot up front and mechanic behind. A single Liberty engine up on the nose, 420 horsepower. The same basic engine that had powered the war wingspan of about 50 feet. Built of wood and steel tube and fabric, doped and painted, the whole thing held together with wire and faith. And here's the clever part. They designed it so the crews could swap between wheels and pontoons. Big float pontoons for the ocean crossings and the coastal legs, and regular landing wheels for the stretches over land, because there was no such thing as a runway waiting for you in most of the world back then. They built five of them, one for testing and four for the flight, and they named them after American cities, one from each corner of the country. The Seattle, the Chicago, the Boston, and the New Orleans. 28 men had volunteered. The Army picked 8, 4 pilots, 4 mechanics, 2 to an airplane. The commander was a major named Frederick Martin, flying the Seattle, and among the rest were a couple of lieutenants whose names you ought to know, because they're the reason this story has an ending. A young officer named Lowell Smith, and another named Eric Nelson, who understood those Liberty engines better than just about anybody alive. They lifted off from Seattle on April 2nd, 1924, heading north and west into Alaska, and almost immediately the world tried to kill them.
Picture it. You're sitting in an open cockpit. No heater. No enclosed cabin. The wind is coming across the nose at better than 70 knots and it's below freezing. Your breath frosts on your goggles, your hands go numb inside your gloves, and you're working a stick and a throttle and you cannot feel your fingers. Below you is the North Pacific coast, some of the ugliest weather on Earth. Fog that comes down to the water, rain that turns to ice on the wings, mountains hidden in the murk. And this is where they lost the first airplane. Up in Alaska, in the fog, Major Martin and his mechanic in the Seattle got separated from the group. They were trying to catch up, flying low along the coast, and they flew straight into the side of a mountain. Fog so thick they never saw it coming. Now here's the part that'll put a lump in your throat. They survived the crash, both of them, but they were stranded in the Alaskan wilderness, in the snow, no radio, no rescue coming, nobody even sure where they'd gone down. And these two men walked out. 10 days. 10 days through the snow and the cold, eating emergency rations, until they stumbled into a fishing cannery, alive. The commander of the whole expedition, walking out of the wilderness on foot. But the Seattle was gone, and Major Martin, by the rules of the flight, was out. Command passed to Lieutenant Lowell Smith in the Chicago. Three airplanes left. They pressed on, across the Aleutians, that long chain of islands reaching out toward Asia, some of the worst flying weather anywhere on the globe. Then a jump across the water to the Kamchatka coast, then down along Japan. And everywhere they went, crowds came out to see them, because remember, the world was watching this race. Every landing was front page news. These young Americans in their open biplanes, hopping from country to country like something out of a storybook. Down through Japan, into China, landing on rivers, taxiing their pontoons up to riverbanks where people had never seen a flying machine in their lives. Through Shanghai and Hong Kong, then Indochina and Siam, what we call Thailand today. The heat now instead of the cold, tropical storms, monsoon rain coming down so hard it stung your face like buckshot, bugs and fever and engines running hot and air thick as soup, and this is the thing I want you to feel. There was no support the way we'd think of it. There were advance parties, Navy ships positioned along the route, spare parts staged at ports around the world. But when an engine failed over the water, it was two men and their own two hands. Eric Nelson and the other mechanics, they changed entire engines out in the open, floating on pontoons in some harbor, hoisting a 500-pound Liberty up with a rope and a prayer. They rebuilt these airplanes over and over, new engines, new wings, new pontoons, patching fabric, splicing wire. By the end, there was hardly an original part left on any of them. The airplane that finished was the airplane in name and spirit, rebuilt a dozen times over on the far side of the world. Across India, across the deserts of the Middle East, where the heat rising off the sand threw the little biplanes around like leaves, up through Turkey and into Europe, Paris, London, and everywhere, the same. Crowds by the thousands, kings and generals and ordinary folks all coming to shake the hands of these tired, sunburned, oil-stained American boys who were doing the impossible one leg at a time. Now they faced the big one, the North Atlantic. The plan was to cross from the top of the world, down from Scotland up to the Orkney Islands, across to Iceland, on to Greenland, and finally to Labrador in North America. The cold ocean crossing. And this is where the sea took the second airplane. The Boston, flown by Lieutenant Lee Wade, developed an oil pressure problem out over the water between the Orkneys and Iceland. The engine was failing. Wade set that biplane down on the open North Atlantic, on the swells, and there they sat, bobbing on their pontoons in the middle of the ocean, waiting. A Navy ship came and tried to hoist the Boston up out of the water to save her, but the sea was too rough. As they lifted her, she was damaged and finally she capsized and had to be cut loose. The crew was saved. The airplane went to the bottom of the Atlantic, two down, two left, the Chicago and the New Orleans. Just those two now out of the four that left Seattle. And they made the crossing. Iceland, Greenland, that brutal cold water leg where a forced landing meant almost certain death, and they made it. When those two little biplanes touched down in Labrador, back on North American soil, they had done what no aircraft had ever done. They had flown across an ocean and made it the whole way around, but they weren't finished. They flew down the coast, and now the crowds were American crowds. Boston, where they'd lost the airplane by that name, but a spare, the prototype, had been sent up and christened the Boston 2 to fly the final legs in formation, New York City, Washington. And then west, across their own country, the country these men had left behind almost 6 months before, they landed back in Seattle on the 28th of September, 1924. Around the world, 26,000 miles, give or take, roughly 175 days, nearly 6 months of flying, coast to coast to coast, across two dozen countries and every kind of weather God ever made. The first flight around the world in the history of the human race. And it was American. Now let me tell you why this matters, because it's easy to hear a story like that and file it away as a stunt. It wasn't a stunt. Every ocean you and I take for granted today, every airliner that crosses the Atlantic tonight with 200 people reading and sleeping in the back, every one of those flights traces back to a question that these eight men answered with their own bodies. Can it be done? Can a machine and the men who fly it cross the whole planet and live? Before 1924, nobody knew for certain. After 1924, everybody did, and I think about those mechanics. We tell these stories and we name the pilots, and we should. But it was Eric Nelson and the men in the back seats, the wrench turners who kept those Liberty engines running with baling wire and stubbornness in harbors on the other side of the earth. Aviation has always been that way. For every name on the trophy, there's somebody in the hangar with grease to the elbows who made the whole thing possible. Don't ever forget those folks. And here's a thing that gets me, sitting here all these years later. Those airplanes were open cockpits, No canopy, no cabin, nothing between the pilot and the whole wide world, but a little windscreen and a leather coat. They felt every mile of it. The cold off the glaciers, the heat off the Indian deserts, the salt spray of every ocean. They didn't fly over the world. They flew through it, out in the open air, the way the oldest and purest kind of flying always was. What one of those airplanes is still with us. The Chicago hangs today in the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, right there where you can stand under it and look up and think about what it carried and where it went. And the New Orleans survives too, out west. Go stand under one of them someday. Look at how small it is, how simple. And then imagine the whole world unrolling underneath it. One river, one harbor, one mountain pass at a time. That's the golden age, folks. Not the trophies and the pylon races, although we love those too. It's this, ordinary men and fragile machines, asking whether a thing could be done, and then going out and doing it because somebody had to be first. I got most of today's story from the good records kept by the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum and the historical accounts of the United States Air Force, who've never let the memory of those eight men fade. You can find us at RadioHangard.com if you want to sit a while longer. The Chicago and the New Orleans came home. The Seattle and the Boston didn't. But all four went around the world, one way or another, and I'd say every one of those men earned his place at the front of the hangar. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the greasy side down, and I'll see you next time.